Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode, Loretta Dignam has pioneered menopause in Ireland. As founder and CEO, she opened the doors of the Menopause Hub, Ireland's first and only dedicated perimenopausal clinic in January 2019. This was one of only two clinics in the world dedicated to menopause. The Menopause Hub is a centre of excellence and now has three clinics in Ireland and Ireland's first menopause app, which is available free and which also acts as an adjunct to the patient care pathway. Loretta is a passionate advocate of menopause women, smashing the taboo and striving to make menopause mainstream. Through the Menopause Hub Academy, she has also developed a CPD accredited programme to support organisations with menopause in the workplace awareness, education, training and policy development, and hosts the Menopause Workplace Excellence Awards in partnership with Great Place to Work and has created the Menopause Workplace Accreditation Programme to recognise those who are leading the way in menopause to support at work. Loretta has a lengthy and highly successful career working for many multinational global businesses including Mars, Diageo, Kerry Group, Anarda and Jacobs Fruitfield as a Senior Marketing and Communications Leader. She's a multi-award winner, Marketer of the Year, Tattler Woman of the Year for Health in 2024, sponsored by ourselves in Davy, Women's Health CEO of the Year, Entrepreneur of the Year runner-up for the Image Businesswoman Awards and the High FemTech 2023 winner. I hope I have them all there. But Loretta, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan. Yeah, how many times can you mention menopause in
I know. I don't even, you know, there'll be no prize for guessing what we're going to talk about. So, right, to kick things off, I think the best place to start is tell me how a career in FMCG or consumer goods marketing transected with the menopause and a desire to advocate on the topic.
Well, I didn't have a lifelong ambition to work in menopause, I can assure you. I was working in the corporate sector and, as I said, in marketing and in FMCG. And at 49, I had what was to be my last period and menstrual period. And then I very quickly got hot flushes. And they were the only two things I knew about menopause. No periods and hot flushes. And I'd never heard the word perimenopause. So all those symptoms that I experienced, I never knew were connected to menopause. So I got those treated individually and went for so many tests and different things. And obviously they didn't improve. But at 49, I thought, firstly, I must be too young for this. Surely I'm too young. I must be the youngest woman in Ireland to ever experience this. Nobody was talking about it. So it was quite lonely. And none of my friends were talking about it either. My mother hadn't spoken about it. So I found it, you know, challenging to kind of navigate. And then in work, I said, right, there's no way I'm going to mention I'm menopausal in work, because my perception of a menopausal woman was somebody who was kind of over the hill, much older than me, past it, crazy lady. And I just thought, well, you know, this will not do me well. And so anyway, after about 3 years of putting up with symptoms that I was aware of, I then went on hormone replacement therapy, which was a game changer for me. And once I started to feel back to myself and I got my va-va-voom back and so on, I started talking to other women and to realise that this problem was similar across women, and yet no one was talking about it. And I guess there were a few emotions. One was kind of a bit of rage in the sense of, why is no one addressing this? A second one was like, I sort of felt for my parents' generation, my mother, what they had to go through in terms of menopause. And then I looked at my daughter who was going through puberty and I went, oh my goodness, the amount of things you have to go through as a female working because of your hormones and so on. And then you get to menopause and no one talks about it. So I decided I'm going to do something about this. So I'm a very practical, pragmatic person. So I decided I'm going to offer services. So I decided to set up a menopause clinic, as you do, with no experience in the area of medicine. But I found a doctor who was willing to come on board and help us start. And that was the beginning of it. And so we opened the first clinic and now we have, and then COVID happened and we had to pivot to online and the digital world, which the medical system wasn't really prepared for. And then I opened two subsequent clinics. And menopause has taken off. It's become a very hot topic, pun intended. And, you know, the UK and Ireland, everybody's talking about menopause. Men talk to me about perimenopause.
Was it ever your intention to start a business? Or did the business just emerge out of necessity to get what you wanted to do, which was to, you know, improve the awareness of menopause within society?
It was very much a problem that arose. I was happy in my corporate sector role and going along until this happened. And so really, I think in our pre-podcast chat, you were saying accidental entrepreneur. I would say yes, most definitely accidental. Yeah, I never thought I never imagined I'd be doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Why do you think there were only two clinics worldwide when you opened the doors to the Menopause Hub? It would strike me that, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if you said to me there was only two clinics in Ireland or in the UK or whatever, but to go the whole world, how come there was only two?
Because menopause has been so taboo for so long. Women didn't talk about it. The medical profession didn't really engage in it. And because it was so taboo, it was like it didn't exist. And as a result, there was nothing dedicated for it. And I remember doing research in advance and asking women, what do they think if I set up this clinic? And they were like, oh my goodness, sign me up. When can I get on the waiting list? I asked men, what do they think? They said, oh, is there not one already? There should be. And when I asked the medical community, they said, oh no, we have that covered in general practice and in, you know, in gynecological work. And the truth was, from the research that I did, and I would say the power of research, of, you know, inquiring and understanding about your customers and your consumers, meant that there was nothing in existence. And when we opened, we actually did have a waiting list.
And is that, do you think that's where the marketing background helped you in terms of that, you know, they always say find your market, define your market when you have a product?
I would say the whole marketing background that I have and the tools and the processes and all of that hugely played into this because literally I did focus groups in my house with women, and I went and did my market research, my quantitative research, and I looked at my proposition and all of that. So I would say yes, all my training and skills and experience in that would have helped me enormously.
The other thing too, I suppose, when you think about it, like if you go back 10 years ago, there wasn't the focus on mental health in the workplace that there is today, right? So in time, will we just have, you know, in a couple of years' time, do you think we'd be talking about you know, menopause in the workplace in the same way we're talking about mental health in the workplace?
I absolutely do. And now if you talk to anybody who does mental health work in the workplace, they would argue the work isn't done. Mm-hmm. And Ireland and the UK are leading out globally in the area of menopause. Mm-hmm. So the US is only starting to talk about it. And now since Donald Trump has come out in his inauguration and talked about diversity, equity and inclusion being rolled back on, I don't know what's going to happen there. But countries that we would normally look up to from the healthcare perspective, like Germany, Scandinavia and so on, they haven't even started. They're only just starting to talk about this. So it's really been Ireland and the UK that have been spearheading this globally. But yes, it's very much like the mental health kind of journey, taboo. And now it's more spoken about. But like there's a lot of work to be done still.
And again, going back to that same thing where you said earlier about, well, you know, the GPs would have said, well, that was their belly. They would have said the same thing about mental health many, many years ago, and that it was, you know, it's a kind of an everyday ill. It's, you know, it's not going to kill you. So, you know, we can deal with it at the GP side.
I would say there's huge parallels between those two. And I would often say to organisations, you know, they'd say, well, how do we go about, you know, tackling menopause? And I'd say, well, do you have anything around mental health already? And they'd say, yeah. And I'd say, well, it's not dissimilar to mental health, and any of the things you put in place for that may equally apply for this or to this. And so, yeah, I would say the parallels are very strong there.
And do you think then ultimately that you need to get, you know, the menopause needs to get a few kind of high profile actors in the same way ultimately the mental health did years ago, and now everybody wants to talk about it?
Yeah, Davina McCall has done a great job in the UK, and we've a few people out talking about it in Ireland as well. And then Joe Duffy got an email about menopause, and he talked for 8 consecutive days and dedicated his programme to that. And they were the kind of things that lifted the lid on it. And in the US, celebrities are out talking about it as well. And I think, you know, they make it seem more mainstream, really. So yes, lots of parallels and lots of similarities, yeah.
How much of the work is around education rather than changing an attitude or a point of view?
Yeah, it's all actually about education.
Right.
And I always say that, you know, menopause is like a hidden cost to the employer. Because, you know, it's not as if they set out to say, well, we're not going to do anything about this menopause thing. It's actually they didn't know. And if no one's talking about it, and nobody, then nobody knows it's an issue. So the whole thing around education, so it's education for the women themselves as to what's actually happening to them by way of symptoms and treatment and so on. Then there's education for partners. And we've just conducted a piece of research around men. Normally, we have an annual survey and we do the research among women, but this year we did it among men. And the appetite among men is quite huge to learn more and have more information. And then employers, so whether it's line managers, supervisors, HR, or whatever, that they get an understanding. And once you understand it, then it demystifies it. And the solutions are not as complex as one might imagine. And a lot of workplaces already have a lot of things in place, like hybrid working, flexible working, that kind of thing, that they could, all they need to do really is look at things through the eyes of a menopausal woman, and then they will also see that they have a lot of things that could apply to that too.
The only thing I suppose that is interesting when you look at the setting up the business, you know, starting it means you've got to wear an awful lot of hats. Like you came with the marketing one, and now you, and in a way you were lucky because you didn't have or didn't necessarily need the medical hat to wear. But let's look at it from the starting a business perspective. A lot of hats to wear. A lot of people think they need to be good at all of those hats and they don't. So, you know, where tell us about your journey about setting up the business and the different things. And you know, when you look back, are you sorry you maybe didn't take a co-founder in with other business experience that would have helped you that bit as well?
Well, when I started off, I knew I'd gathered a huge amount of skills and experience through my working life. I would have been quite a commercial marketer, so I would have had, you know, P&Ls, profit and loss would have been important to us, new product launches, so trying to get new products out there and so on. So I'd be, you know, reasonably commercially savvy. So that was a good place to start. On reflection, I think it would have been better to have a co-founder, to be honest. And I would like to have had a medical one at the outset, but I just didn't come across the right people and it just didn't come together. But I would have thought, I often think that being a solo founder is quite lonely because, you know, who do you bounce things off and so on and so on. So you need to surround yourself with kind of support groups, mentors, networking groups and things where you can bounce things off. But yeah, I mean, I think the skills that I lacked, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And if I knew then what I know now, I don't know that I would have really started it. But things I learned very quickly, and I know I hear you say on some of the other podcasts, is that, you know, every day is a school day. I'm learning so much. But it is so invigorating to actually learn so much. Because after a while in the roles that I was doing in the corporate sector, you get to a point whereby, you know, it's another year, another product, another plan, another. Whereas this is absolutely, it kind of blows my mind in terms of the learning. Now, there's also lots of challenges, don't get me wrong. And even the problem solving around those challenges can be difficult at times, but also can be hugely invigorating because you're solving a problem that you didn't even know you could solve.
Or didn't know existed two
days
ago.
absolutely. And there's like never a dull day. There's always something new. I always kind of liken it to, you know, whack-a-mole. You know, you've just whacked down the last thing and you think, oh, phew. And then up pops another one and you've got to go for that. And sometimes two or three at the same time. But like I did everything from the outset except see patients. So I was on the reception, so I did the, you know, worked on the website, did all the, with somebody who was able to do that work, but did all the branding work, did all the marketing, all the PR. I got fabulous PR actually myself. I was the receptionist. I was doing the appointments, taking the money, bringing the people in, the women in to see the doctor, etc., etc. I did it all. I emptied the bins. I painted the offices. I built the desks from IKEA furniture. I did it all. And the great thing about that is that when you get into hiring staff, I know all of those roles, with the exception of the medical one, you know. So, yeah, I think some what you don't know is good. And ignorance is a bit bliss, really. I think the second thing is you'd be surprised at the skills you've acquired in life, whether it's, you know, through being a mother, being running a household, working, and all the things you've picked up. And there is an application for them all. And if there isn't, you'll learn it.
How do you feel about what you've done so far in the company?
Well, the last thing that I did this year, which I suppose is one of the most thrilling things, is that I, through campaigning with government and ministers and so on, and opposition parties, and then I got to put together a petition. I wanted the government to introduce free hormone replacement therapy for all the women in Ireland. And I'd hoped it to be, ambitiously hoped it to be included as part of Budget 2025, never thinking that it would ever actually happen. But it did. Now, it hasn't been implemented yet because of issues between the pharmacy union and the government and this, that and the other. But it will happen this year. And that's a huge thrill. However, the thing I'd say is I don't tend to sit back very often and go, pat myself on the back and go, God, aren't you great? Because there's always another, you know, mole to whack. And there's always more to be done and the next step and the next goal. So I suppose if I did take the time out, I'd be pretty proud. But I think there's still a, you know, that, do you remember that saying of that government party? Lots done, more to do.
Yeah.
There's a huge element of that, you know.
Yeah. What personal characteristics do you think are most important as a founder or a CEO of a company?
I think focus and determination is hugely important. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I know what my goal is, and I'm focused on that. And all the things that happen along the way, I deal with, but I still have to keep focused on that. So that focus and determination and that goal kind of setting thing is really important. I think resilience, I mean, one of my theme songs is, you know, I get knocked down and then and I get up again. Because honestly, you know, there's some days where I say to myself, why are you doing this, Loretta? And I'll chat to my kids. They're grown up now. I call them my kiddults. And I'll say to them, I don't know why I'm doing this. And part of me goes, well, actually, I chose to do this. I chose to scale and grow my business. I could choose for it to be a lifestyle business, or I could have chosen not to go into it at all and continued on in the corporate sector and be a kind of approaching retirement maybe. But I've chosen to do this. And when I remind myself that, I go, OK, you have choices. And this is what you've chosen. So get on with that. And that's
But you also believe in it. Like, do you know what I mean? That's another thing.
The purpose is huge.
That clarity of purpose is essential.
Huge. You know? And it really, I really feel really passionate about it. And I could bore you to death about it as well. But I really do feel passionately about it. And we are changing lives. I met a woman the other night at an event, like a business event, and it was networking and all that. And I said hello to her. And when she asked me, you know, we were exchanging what we do, whatever, she said to me, you saved my life. And I was really, now I've heard this lots of times before, but I was really thrown because it was in a very different setting and I wasn't expecting her to be a patient of our clinic. Once upon a time, I probably would have known all the patients when I was working there, but now it's grown and we have practice manager and other people running it. But she said to me, you saved my life. And she described, you know, how she was, you know, not getting on well. She was, her health wasn't good, her quality of life. And then she came to us and that transformed her. And she started to get emotional and I started to get emotional. And luckily they, you know, rang the bell or whatever for the start of it. But that would happen to me fairly regularly. I was at a festival a couple of years ago and it was lashing rain and it was, you know, with a hood on and everything. And this woman passed me by and then she shouted out, you saved my life. And she pulled a few people in, my friends, into a conversation. Now, first of all, how she recognised me was beyond me. But anyway, and she said that. And I always find that very emotional every time. So, yeah, there's that huge element of it. And that's the thing that keeps me going. So that, the passion, the goal, the purpose and the resilience, I think, and energy. It's not for the faint-hearted, I can tell you. Do you know what I mean? You do really need to have your energy levels up.
Going from working with big global companies to running your own show, pros and cons, please.
Well, when I started off, I worked with Mars and that was an amazing business to work with. And of course, it was my formative years, you know, just straight out of university, etc. But I learned some great things. But there are a lot of resources there in those big companies, you know, whether they're even they don't even have to be that big, but people are a huge resource. Skills, processes, money, and so on. So, and when then you start off again and you've none of those, that can be a huge challenge. And one of the things, when I had brand managers who reported into me when on my team and so on, and one of the things I always used to say is that, you know, you need to consider these budgets as if it was your money. So, you know, would you do this if it was your money? Because sometimes they'd be making these proposals and you'd be like, would you do that for your money? And sometimes they'd turn around and say, well, actually, no. And I'd say, well, why are you asking the business to spend its money on this? So that was one of the kind of the one of the tenets of stuff I would always have. And now I'm in that scenario and I'm like, is that a good investment to spend that amount of money on A, B or C? And it mightn't be a huge amount of money either. So that I found hard, and you have to be really resourceful yourself. You know what I mean? And so I look up things that I would never have looked up before. I've watched videos. I've done all sorts. And then the other thing you can do, though, which has been hugely powerful for me, is that you can contract people in for particular services. So you don't have to take them full time on a payroll. And that suits a lot of people. And so you buy the skills in as you need them. But yeah, that's a huge adjustment. Yeah. That's a huge adjustment. Yeah. But sometimes when you've less money, you have to be more creative.
The other thing, too, is that when I talk to different people on the show over the last while, you know, Ireland is a great place in terms of people that you might not know willing to help you. If you pick up the phone and just go, you know, do you know anybody with this? Oh, no, I don't do you, but I know somebody will. And, you know, it's amazing the amount of people who have started a business and said, I didn't know this fella, got his number, rang him, had a cup of coffee with him or her, and they told me about this.
It's phenomenal, and it never ceases to amaze me how generous people are with their time, with their knowledge, with their experience, with whatever. And that whole networking thing is hugely powerful. And that has been hugely powerful and supportive for me, because I would have tapped into my own network and they would have done exactly that. But I'm always flabbergasted at how generous people are. And I know, as an entrepreneur, I don't often have the time really to do that. But I remember the people who are usually helpful to me. And therefore, it's about kind of paying it forward or paying it back, whichever.
Yeah. Or both.
Exactly. And I think, I don't know how well that works in other markets, but I've seen it work in other markets. I've been, we're looking to scale and expand in other markets, and people have generously said, oh, I can put you in touch with that person and that person and that person. And lo and behold, before you know it, you can be with the decision maker that would have taken you a much longer
Long time
to get to.
You've had lots of different roles in the various different companies along your career. How did you know it was the right time to leave a role or move on to the next one?
I think I used to always say, you know, you need to be in a role a minimum of 3 years and a relationship as well. Because the first year is all about the learning and, you know, whatever, whatever. The second year is kind of, you know, getting into your stride, starting to prove yourself and so on. And then the third year is kind of a bit more of the mastering of it. And so I think the minimum kind of 3 years to me would be a good stretch. But the thing that always motivated me, like money is has never been a motivator except as a measure of success, if you know what I mean. Not the actual money, but, you know, getting paid more to take on more responsibility, I liked. But to my mind, it was always learning or doing something new or different or a challenge. So typically, I never did the same thing for all. I was in Mars for 13 years, but I worked in the UK in sales. I started off, then I worked in Ireland in marketing, and I worked on different portfolios. And then I went to work in Sweden for 4 years, and then I came back, and then I went to work in Diageo. So I never stayed in the exact same role for all that length of time. I was always kind of moving, taking on more responsibility, moving up the ladder of the of seniority, you know, getting more people on my team and facing slightly different challenges and always learning. So that to me was the thing. But I suppose when you stop learning is a time and you stop, I don't know, the reward benefit thing.
You start going backwards, I think. If you stop learning, you go backwards.
Yeah. And the reward benefit, getting the words right, you know what I mean? So if the energy isn't as positive as it was, I start to look at things and then go, and then maybe I need a new challenge. So I think that's the big thing. And I've learned in the entrepreneurial role, oh my goodness, I have learned so much. I feel it's taken at least 15 or 20 years off me. by learning
terms of your
so
energy
much.
Level.
Yeah, yeah, I really do. Yeah.
How would you define the culture in the Menopause Hub now, and how has it been different establishing in one from a starting point rather than going into the corporate one where it comes down and you are a Mars person, you are a Diageo person, you are a Kerry person?
Yeah, I suppose when I started off and when there's a very small number of employees, you know, you're not kind of, you know, you don't do a lot of work and soul searching about what kind of culture you want to develop because it's the two of you doing the job, just get on with it.
But more important to balance the cash flow.
Exactly, and get the patients through the door. But what I did do is I looked at the values of what we were trying to create. And so the values of our business are the three E's. And of course, I'm from marketing, so I'd have to have three E's, wouldn't I? So the first one is education. So we're about education. The next one is empathy. And, you know, it was particularly outward focused for patients, but it's understanding and empathy and, you know, listening and so on, and believing in what the person has to say. And then the third one is empowerment. So it's empowering people to women to make the choice about their health and how they're going to manage it through menopause. So they were the values, the external values of the business, but they're also kind of the internal values. But as the business grows bigger, you know, you need more policies. You need to look at the culture. You need to look at some of the processes. You need to have kind of, you know, equity across for all the staff. And that's a challenge in itself, you know, because all the time as an entrepreneur, you're being advised to work on the business and not in the business. And it's so easy every day to be in the business because the demands and the resources aren't there. And so I guess our culture is evolving. I'm a big believer. I'm not a micromanager. I absolutely abhor that. I would be very much a delegator. I learned that in Mars, actually, and about giving people responsibility, but also the authority with it. So, and accountability. And so that's how I like to work with the teams. I also like to be seen as a team player with the team, as opposed to I'm the authoritative, you know, boss or whatever. You know, I don't have all the answers. Now, it took me a long time to work that out when I was, growing up through my career. I felt as the line manager of a team and as a direct report of my you know, marketing director or general manager or CEO, whatever, that I always had to have the answers. You know, I had to answer to the direct reports or I had to give the answers to the people up the line. I now realise I don't have all the answers and I couldn't possibly have all the answers. And that's a very refreshing place to be.
A bit liberating.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And I can say to the team, I don't know that yet, but let's try and work through it. And I value your opinion and I value, you know, and then we'll bring in different mentors or different resources to help us answer the, you know, to work it out.
On that basis then, you know, who have you? Who do you seek advice from?
Well, I'll tell you what I found hugely beneficial is that when I was starting off, I actually did one of those LEO, the local enterprise office, how to start your own business courses, which I actually found to be great, to be honest. It was only a few weeks and it was, you know, I wasn't working. I hadn't, you know, left the corporate world as such. So I did it in the evening and worked through whatever. And that was huge. They asked me the right questions and whatever. And they helped me put together a business plan and all that. And that was brilliant. The next area is I've joined a lot of kind of, what would you call it, entrepreneur groups. So I was part of Going for Growth for two different years in a row, which is about female entrepreneurs. And they're mentors of people who've been more successful on their business journey who come back and mentor and coach kind of the members of that. So I did that for a couple of years. Plus you build up a huge network of other people who are on the same journey as you. And it's really great to feel not alone. It's really great to share problems because we all face more or less the similar problems, although whatever we're selling or marketing or providing is very different. So that's great. And I just think, and that also leads to more contacts and widens your network. So I joined that. I also qualified or was accepted onto the EY Entrepreneurial Winning Women program, which is phenomenal. Wow, that's global. And that was hugely powerful for me to meet even, you know, more successful people. I'm reading a book at the moment called, I think, what's it called? I think it's called Thinking Bigger or Think Big. And it's written by one of the women who was on the EY winning programme. And she sold her business for $100 million in the US. And so I'm reading her book at the minute. And I've met her personally and I reached out to her recently on a WhatsApp group. Things like that are invaluable, like invaluable. So I would say, and then I have other people that I've met along the way and I've said, you know, I need some mentoring around this at the moment. So sales or financial account, the finance side of things, or, you know, building the team or whatever. And I've sourced those services and, you know, that's hugely comforting and it makes you feel as if you're not on your own.
We mentioned earlier on the importance of clarity of purpose, right? And that's definitely the case within the business. But then when it comes to dealing with your investors and your backers, how essential is it that they're aligned with what you're trying to achieve?
Well, I'll have to say, I'd never raised funding from private investors before. And this summer, I closed the first round of that. And it's fascinating because I only started looking for money from investors in about May. And I had it closed down by the middle of August. And all of the people that invested initially offered me investment. So when they knew what I was doing, they said, oh, I like what you're doing. It aligns with my goals, my values, my purpose, my whatever. I'd be interested in investing. I know when I go out for the next round, it's going to be much different. but yeah, that was, they were aligned and they saw what I was trying to achieve. And therefore, for them, I suppose it was, you know, if it makes sense on in terms of business plan, then they found it easier to get on board for that very reason.
Oftentimes we see, you know, with success comes the risk of distraction. You go into areas that you shouldn't. Now, you've been slightly different than that, you know, although there's a second leg to the stool after developing in terms of the accreditation and the that side of the business. So take me through that jump from the clinics into the next part of the business development.
Well, I guess when I set up the Menopause Hub at the beginning, I always say, you know, paper doesn't refuse ink and an Excel spreadsheet and it doesn't refuse numbers.
Of course, yeah.
So I put together a business plan. I said, oh, you know, I'd love to have a number of clinics around the country, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't really see it as, you know, a big business opportunity. I saw it really as fixing a problem. Anyway, as the business grew and the whole demand grew, and I have to say, we never had a problem in creating demand, which was a phenomenal place to be. We actually had the opposite. We had a problem in trying meeting demand and getting on board additional doctors and things like that. And, you know, thankfully, we worked through that. And I didn't have any medical credibility. So it was really important to establish that. Anyway, along the way, through my research, market research and so on, we discovered that 10% of menopausal and perimenopausal women leave work because of their symptoms. 4 in 10 consider leaving work because of their symptoms. 4 out of 10 women take time off work due to their symptoms. 1 in 5 take 3 or more days. And so I thought, oh, not only is this a problem for women in their own lives, in their personal lives, it's also a problem for women in the workplace. But equally, it's a problem for employers.
For the workplace.
Yeah. And it's about staff retention. And menopause hits in the age of 45, 55, just when women are, you know, moving into the peak of their career, taking on more responsibility. The gender pay gap is really important. Diversity, equity and inclusion is really important. And therefore, it's kind of like a perfect storm. So, and in addition, there is actually legislative risk because in the UK, they're looking to bring in legislation, and the bill is going through at the moment, that organisations of 250 employees or more have to have a published workplace policy around menopause. And there's been a number of cases, a triple-fold increase in the cases taken in the UK, where women have taken case and won on the grounds of age, gender and disability discrimination. So when I discovered all this, I thought, gosh, you know, we really need to be talking to workplaces. And there's a hidden cost, as I said earlier, of menopause, because nobody spoke about it. And so then anyway, I was thinking, gosh, the demand for the business is growing. And then I suppose I started in all of these networks hearing about investment and scaling and all this kind of thing. And I thought, oh, Maybe I should do that. And so I had a crossroads moment when I was thinking about how should I scale my business, because I can't do it all. And I think making choices is really, really important, because as you said, distraction is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at, could I scale my clinics internationally? And I thought, ideally, maybe I could, but there's different healthcare in health insurance places, different payment structures and companies, different medical legal, you know, and so on and so on. And, you know, maybe I should be, it should be a franchise model. And but anyway, that kept coming up against kind of barriers. And then I thought, well, you know, by 2030, there's going to be 1.1 billion menopausal women on the planet. And every year, 47 million newly menopausal women will come into that cohort. And the number of working women in that, in perimenopausal and menopausal age, is a huge global opportunity. So I thought, maybe it's, I should scale the training and accreditation side of the business. So I invested in creating e-learning. It's all CPD accredited. And that's the area that I decided to focus on. And it was under, you know, because I was doing it as well as expanding the clinics and setting up new clinics and so on, I took it out from underneath the Menopause Hub and created Menopause Hub Academy. So they're two separate limited businesses. And that's the vehicle that I went to towards looking for fundraising for, so I can scale and explore that. I hope I'm right. Time will tell.
How do you deal with setbacks?
There's big setbacks and small setbacks. The first time, the first setback I ever had was when a doctor said she didn't want to stay, she was going to move on. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to, because I can't provide that service. And I thought, my goodness. And I was devastated. And out of the blue, more doctors applied for positions with us. And it was like, oh my God, that was close call. The next time a doctor maybe handed in their resignation or is going on maternity leave or something, I thought, I don't really bat an eyelid now, because I've been through that, I know whatever. So how do I deal with setbacks? I am very resilient. And I might be down, when I say down, you know what I mean? But I might be a bit upset, or now I'm not talking about crying or lying awake at night or anything upset, but you know, a bit kind of, you know, like off, a slap in the face. Yeah, slap in the face. But there's always a way around it. There's always another angle. There's always another way to come at it. And so I just pick myself up and have another go, really, to be honest. And I try to take it in my stride as best I can. So, but each time I face problems, sometimes they're new and sometimes they're ones I've seen before. And if they're new and they're big, that's hard. Yeah. But you know, I talk to other people. That's how I actually problem solve. God love all my friends and family, is I actually talk it out. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And that will also, and then I start to get more perspective and hear other opinions and start to, you know, to absorb it. Mm. And then I start to come out the other side. That's really it.
Do you obsess about the small things?
No, I definitely don't. I genuinely don't. And I read a book there, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff and all the rest. And I don't. And you know, another thing I learned actually in this entrepreneurial space, if I look at sort of, you know, the tech people, so I look at Apple and I look at all of those, and I'm forever getting updates on Apple to fix glitches and make it better and all the rest. And so what I learned really from looking at the tech people is that perfection is the enemy of action. And people think I'm a perfectionist. And I have to say, I'm not. I'm far from a perfectionist. Yeah. And the reason I say is, and I've learned that good enough is good enough.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's why I don't. Now, when I was in the corporate sector, I would have been much more of a perfectionist. And then again, I probably would have the resources and the time and people. And, you know, you can, but, you know, pitch decks. There's one, for example. You could be going forever with a pitch deck. Everybody has an opinion.
Yeah.
After a while, I said, look, this is my pitch deck.
Yeah.
This is it. I'm sure it can be better. I'm sure it can be different. But actually, this is where I'm at right now. So can we discuss it? So I just think, you know, for that, all that extra effort, you won't really make a significant progress.
The marginal gain is
exactly
is limited.
Yeah. Diminishing returns sets in. So no, I don't sweat the small stuff anymore.
What advice would you give to young people?
to young people. I think, well, I'm going to sound as if I'm about 100. I'm not. But
no, I can categorically say she is not, folks.
Thank you. What I will say, though, is that when I was leaving school, it was all about getting a permanent pensionable job. Mm. And I remember when I was leaving school, I got offered jobs with the bank and AIB and Bank of Ireland, whatever. I said I wasn't taking them. I wanted to go to university. And I was the first in my family to go to university. I came from quite a working class background. And my parents said to me, "What? You're not taking the job at the bank? It's permanent and pensionable." And I said,
"Two P's.
No. I'm going somewhere else in life, Mum. Dad." Whereas I look at the younger generation coming through, my daughter, my son, and the way the world is now is I think they can have multiple careers. So I would say to younger people, and there's that saying, you know, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I would say that's where I'm at the moment. I do what I love and I don't feel I work a day in my life. However, when it comes to Saturday and I'm still working, I do feel it. But in general, as a principle. So I would say, you know, do the things you love and enjoy if you can. If you want to start a business, the Nike, just do it. Just do it. And the big thing that I've also learned through entrepreneurial groups and networks and so on is fail fast. Mm. So if you can, and I remember I was involved in the relaunch of Kilkenny Beer when I was working in Diageo, and I said to the business, "We're going to put in place a couple of KPIs, and if we don't achieve them, then I'll make a decision." And after, I think it was, I can't remember, 6 or 9 months or something, I said to the business, "Right, you know, we've achieved trial, but we're not getting repeat rates," meaning people didn't really like it that much. So I said, my suggestion is we change tack and we go for a different strategy, which was actually a tourist brand strategy, and that I give you back the investment, which is around £3 million at the time. I give you back that to invest in one of the other business priorities. And that was an ability to actually say, this isn't working. Mm. And even though I put my blood, sweat and tears into it, I was able to say it's not working. Yeah. And here's, you know, put the money into something else. Once again, if it was my money, I wouldn't keep going with this. Mm. And I think that's the thing. So get in and fail fast. But there'd be plenty of other opportunities to reinvent yourself and to do other things. And I'd say, you know, every time I write a card to my kiddos, I say the world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want. And try and do different things. And I think that's the difference between their generation and my generation.
Could you ever go back to the shop floor? Go back to the old marketing days?
No. Most definitely, I couldn't. Do you know why? Because my mind has expanded so much. My energy has expanded so much. I think I would feel I was put into a little box again or something. Whereas now, you know, I can't say I get up every day excited. Now, that'd be a load of bull. But, you know, I am excited by what I do and what I'm trying to achieve. And I just think that would be too small.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like asking this, and I'd be interested in answering this one, right? We're going to have a dinner party for 6 people. There's you, me and 4 others. You can pick the 4. Who are they and why?
I'd like Michelle Obama there.
Okay.
I think I'd like Donald Trump there.
They won't be in the same room, you know that. Our past few weeks have told you that we might have to have a problem there, but go on.
And 2 others, let me think. Gosh. See, I'm ending up in the political world, which I don't want to do. And I don't know, maybe to an author. Here's a fabulous author. Her name is Caroline Perez. Criado Perez, and she wrote a book called Invisible Women. And I would say to anybody, I recommend this book wholeheartedly. Talk about something that makes a huge impact. It should be on the Leaving Cert, to be honest. Boys and girls should read it. But it's about how having enough females at the table through life, because they were so busy in the home looking after the children and all that kind of thing, they weren't at the table and decisions were then made through the eyes of men. So I think I'd like her at the table. And I think, I don't know who the other one would be. Help me out here. Not sure.
Anybody in sports?
Oh, interesting. Someone from sports.
Sports or business?
Sport. It would definitely be sports or business. Well, I have a businessman there, don't I? A semi-famous, semi-successful businessman. Well,
semi-famous, so I'd say.
So maybe I'd have Gaza there, maybe, or something.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody who had to, you know, who had to, you know, pick themselves up a lot and whatever, maybe, just for the bit of, you know. So I'd have equal men and women there, I think.
Very important.
I do, yeah. And we'd have lots of topics to discuss. One who, you know, there you go.
Interesting, an interesting group. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Oh, great question. Everybody I know thinks I'm really competitive. I wasn't particularly competitive in sport, now, to be honest with you, but they think I'm really competitive. And I probably am. So I probably hate losing more than I love winning. Actually. Yeah, right. I think so. Yeah.
And then the other one I'm always interested in, and it probably it's going to be a bigger one for you in terms of you roll out the business. Hire talent from without or develop from within?
Well, I think if you have talent that has potential, then develop from within. I'm a big believer in that. And I love to see people who have potential and to give them more challenge and opportunity. And so, for example, we've a tiny business and we have so many people on maternity leave. And one of our practice managers is somebody who I think she's well able. I'd rather have her up, you know, step up than bring somebody from the outside in. So I'd be quite a big believer in that. But if you don't have that talent or you don't have that skill, then I think you have to go outside, you know. So I think a combination works well. I don't actually believe in being too preemptive about those things or predetermined.
Or rigid about it.
Yeah. I think it has to be. And look, I've become so much more flexible since I became an entrepreneur.
Necessity is the mother of invention. That's the other side of it.
My mother's favourite saying. She's gone, but that was her favourite saying.
Right. The black book time is out. Ooh. Here we go. The final question.
I'm getting nervous.
All right. What is the greatest piece of business advice you have received?
Trust your instinct, trust your gut. And the reason I say that is because, and it happened recently, I was listening to some different external people's opinions, none of whom had set up a business, I might add, and they gave me some advice and I remember thinking, that's interesting, but I'm not taking that. My gut and my, and it's not only my gut, it's my sort of my fibre of my being sort of made
the DNA.
Made me go, I don't think that's right. And it was interesting because when I was on one of the EY Entrepreneur Winning Women, this lady who sold the business for 100 million, she's like my, I'm fangirling her now. She asked us all to write a letter or, you know, to ourselves, either, you know, to us before we started in our business or, you know, 5 years, depending on how long your business is in operation, but, you know, to your younger self or to when you start your business and, you know, give that letter and what would you say? And people found it really emotional and I did too. And you know what I said? It was trust yourself. And if you'd asked me before I wrote that letter, what did I think? I don't know that I would have said that. But, and basically, it's your ability to respond to problems, to find a solution, to work it out. But it's that trust yourself. And I don't know whether it's whether men trust themselves more instinctively than women. I don't know that. But I, you know, trust myself. So I think I think that's the biggest piece of advice I could have, you know. And if you're a bit wavering on the trust, then maybe it's time to listen to someone else's opinion.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Loretta Dignam. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.